35 degrees Racine, 34 in Kenosha, 32 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very pleased indeed to be sitting opposite a faculty colleague from Carthage College, Dr. Art Sear. You know his name and his voice well from his many years as a regular presence on the morning show, and I'm very, very happy that he can join us today, in part to look back at a momentous occasion in recent history. It was 60 years ago this fall, in fact, 60 years ago this week,
right,
that the terrifying events of the Cuban Missile Crisis unfolded. And we're going to be taking a good chunk of this this upcoming hour to talk about that, and in particular to talk about some of the ways in which we now understand the Cuban Missile Crisis far better than we did at the time. And really, what we know now helps us understand how, in fact, we were even closer to the precipice of out-and-out nuclear war than anybody dared even imagine back then. But that will be coming up a little bit later on in the hour. In the meantime, Dr. Sear, of course, is a not only a member of the faculty at Carthage, but also a columnist whose columns appear all across the country, including regularly in the Kenosha News and other newspapers and journals, both here and abroad, actually. Also author of After the Cold War. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much. You're always so gracious. Before we get started, I do want to acknowledge publicly the tremendous accomplishments of Brian Albrecht, the longtime president of your college, Gateway College, who is retiring after a very long and successful tenure. I never worked for him directly, but I do encounter him regularly in various contexts, including coming upstairs for your program. And his honesty and openness and straightforward nature, as well as his executive ability, have very much paid off for this institution. He is very reminiscent of Greg Campbell, F. Gregory Campbell, a very equally honest and effective executive, very long-term successful president of Carthage College, one of the other educational institutions right along here, along with Parkside. These people become more and more valuable, I believe, in education and the nonprofit sector. Generally, as our very wealthy and in many ways very indulgent society evolves over time. So I do want to underscore how appreciative we all are or should be for this fine executive.
Right.
Glad to see you agree.
Yeah, I very much do. I vividly remember when he first came to Gateway, and that would be 16 or 17 years ago, and that was during the tenure of his predecessor, Dr. Sam Borden. And I remember, for a while, all I saw was this young man following in the footsteps of Dr. Borden. And at that point, I had no idea that this was Brian Albrecht or who he was or actually the high position he had at the college then. Very quickly, it came to understand what a formidable force of nature he was. And yes, over the course of these last 16 years of his presidency, he has done all kinds of things to transform Gateway into a really enviable technical college and really helped reshape the definition of that. I mean, he kind of came aboard at a time when technical colleges were regarded in a certain way and not always in a fully, respectful way.
Yes.
And I think people look at a school like Gateway very, very differently now. And the successes that they've had have been remarkable. And he would be the first to say they're due to the efforts of a whole lot of gifted people. But there's no question that he has been the spearhead of this great growth.
Another sign of a very good effective executive, Tom Clawson, Carthage College graduate, went on to run Bank of America and the World Bank. I'm honored that we became acquainted after I came to work in this area. And a very honest man, a truly great executive, not an easy man to deal with. He didn't hand out a lot of compliments, I must say, but he was very good at sharing credit. Mm. Both in B of A and the World Bank. It's in the written record. He was a highly demanding boss, but he got things done successfully. And I'm impressed by the loyalty of the people who worked for him. I got to meet actually a number of them over the years.
Hmm.
Yeah, we've got to value these people more and more.
Absolutely. And loyalty says a lot about the quality of somebody's leadership. I mean, when you inspire loyalty in those around you, that says a lot.
So. More and more they tend to go, given American historical culture, more and more they tend to go into the private sector rather than into public service, the government, or the nonprofit and education sectors. So they're more valuable than ever. Mm. They're more valuable than ever.
Mm. I also want to acknowledge, while we're acknowledging President Albrecht, the fact that I very much appreciated the way in which he followed in his predecessor's footsteps in terms of wanting to work cooperatively with both UW-Parkside and Carthage, and that the three leaders of those three schools have had a very close, friendly, and valuable working relationship and friendship over all of these years. And, of course, there's a lot of places with institutions of higher learning that are, in close proximity that are fierce rivals more than anything. And I think it really says a lot about the leaders of those three schools that they have understood the value of the other schools and have wanted to work together and have worked together.
To paraphrase Dwight Eisenhower accurately, I believe anyone can cause conflict, anyone can insult others, anyone can be egocentric, anyone can start a war. What's really hard to do is to get positive results and to get people working together. Hmm. Leadership is getting the other man or woman to do what you want him or her to do because they want to do it.
Hmm.
That takes a hell of a lot of time, human inside work and brains. Much easier to just summon people in, give them orders, do all the talking, tell them how great you are, in effect, and then dismiss them. But really successful institutions that are durable manage to avoid that kind of leadership.
Mm. Very well said.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad you approve.
For those of you just joining us, we have Dr. Arts here with us today, and we're turning our attention now to several of his most recent columns, and ultimately we're going to be talking about what unfolded 60 years ago this fall, the Cuban Missile Crisis. I first want to talk about the fact that, speaking of leadership and good leaders, and also speaking of not so good leaders, that Great Britain, of course, now has a new prime minister after the remarkably short stint of Prime Minister Liz Truss, who is probably best known to the typical American just for those photos taken with Queen Elizabeth II in what amounted to the Queen's final public appearances before falling ill and, of course, ultimately passing away. And it turns out that maybe was among the last public appearances of Prime Minister Liz Truss, who would have thought. First of all, just summarize for our listeners your understanding of what went wrong with her. I mean, what kind of problems was she dealing with and apparently not dealing with very effectively?
The British system is institutionally not as unified as we are. Technically, the monarch is the head of state and the source of authority, which is why Queen Elizabeth II and now King Charles III appoint the prime minister, and they are consulted on major policy matters, and they do have influence, which can be built up or frittered away over time. We're all very fortunate that for 70 years, Elizabeth, quite a remarkable leader, was able to expand her authority through example, related to what we were just talking about, more and more. To actually answer your question, consultation is essential. The parliamentary system in Parliament is supreme in the government in a way that Congress is not in this country. Curiously, she and her inner circle didn't consult at all widely before proposing a radical budget. Very, very dramatic tax cuts for the top income people, the 1% especially. While Britain is suffering high inflation that is considerably more severe and more rooted, I believe, than in our very different economy. And there's a good deal of public alienation from the government. This budget created a tremendous uproar, not only within the public at large and the media, from all parties, including her own party. It also really antagonized the very divided and acrimonious Conservative Party. And she was not able to pursue any further decisions or legislation. Her power disappeared very, very quickly. Something that can happen more easily in Britain than in our more structured political environment and more decentralized environment. I hope that's clear. It is kind of astonishing. But she also started kind of behind the eight ball, because Boris Johnson had been such a tumultuous and divisive figure, but also such a rather like Donald Trump. I think of him as their version of Trump, that any prime minister would have had a hard time given troubled waters, given the stormy political environment in Britain that he left behind. Leaving the European Union, many intelligent people, including the very, very knowledgeable current prime minister, Rishi Sunak, were supportive of Brexit. The British did that for psychological, cultural, historical reasons. They're never comfortable in a close relationship with Europe outside of military alliances. But economically, it's been a terrible, terrible mistake, and that's going to continue.
Brexit was a
Brexit,
mistake.
Leaving the European Union, as leaving, I think I just said. Yes, leaving the Union, which was strongly supported. And indeed, the several prime ministers ago, David Cameron was able to, he proposed a referendum rather complacently, assuming that it would confirm membership in the European Union. And in point of fact, the Leave people just barely won. Anyway, I tend to talk at length on your program. I think that's enough. But it's really important. And Brexit, as there is a looming monster almost that is going to challenge any prime minister.
Right.
And she made a very, very bad decision initially.
It just spoiled everything. you said about her successor, Rishi Sunak, two things that were interesting to me. First of all, you said that he is, in your words, a promising choice. And you also said that the process by which he was selected was reassuring. So what was reassuring about the process by which he was ultimately selected?
Things are so bad in Britain that people generally unified around this one figure. He did compete before for the party leadership and lost to Liz Truss, but she did not win by any great margin, unlike Boris Johnson when he was first seeking the leadership. The Conservative Party has evolved in modern ways dramatically over the last half century. It used to be just the guys getting together, and women, who are much more prominent in British politics than our own, although they're growing in both. They've now had three female prime ministers, quite a significant accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
But it used to be the mostly aristocrats plus some successful business people getting together privately and picking the next, very much a club, which is very British. And they now have a system whereby members of parliament vote to nominate candidates to be prime minister. And if there's more than one, the membership at large around the country votes, people who are dues-paying members of the Conservative Party, more structured, like so many things in that country, much more structured than in the way people become Democrats and Republicans in this country. Things are so bad that competitors simply stepped aside for a gentleman who has not only been Chancellor of the Exchequer, Secretary of the Treasury, great preparation for dealing with their current very, very grim economic challenges, but also a very, very successful investment banker. Mind you, his lineage is from India, and as the your colleagues on NPR keep emphasizing, the race dimension is really important. It's actually not the race dimension. The British relationship with India is quite different from race relations regarding African Americans in this country. And I want to emphasize that, given that I hear this over and over again on public radio, I must say. I appreciate the chance to sound off on your program. He comes from a high caste in India. They have a class system, very hierarchical, like in Britain. And his wife is from the wealthiest family in India, or just about. So he starts with tremendous family influence. He started with a lot of advantages, but you don't make it in investment banking based on social pedigree or how much money you come from. He was phenomenally successful as an investment banker, which there, like here, can be a political liability, but things are so bad, rather like Churchill. Not nearly as dangerous a situation. But Churchill, other parties rallied around Churchill as the wartime leader more than his own Conservative Party. The Liberals and Labor Party really gravitated to him because things were so terrible. We're not there today. We're light years away from that horrible world. But it's a similar phenomenon. They pragmatically decided we need this guy.
Wow.
Badly.
Right, right. So the fact that people are rallying around him is the thing that you find reassuring. And also, you've already outlined a bit of what makes him a promising successor to Liz Truss. I mean, that he brings some know-how and some other gifts to the table that could potentially serve his country well.
Yeah, very smart. He, like Churchill, he's very smart, has the experience. He does not have Winston's baggage. And he's a much smoother operator than Churchill. Probably not as truly brilliant, but thank God we don't need that kind of wartime brilliance today.
Right. And you also, I think, are saying that we should not make too much of his ethnic background, that doesn't matter nearly as much as some of these other things we've been talking about.
Yeah, and the parallel is incorrect. It's wrong. We're so obsessed with race today, especially in radio and television media, as well as our social activists around the country, that it often transcends everything. It's a very incorrect analogy to say what people in your network are constantly referring to, race relations in this country. That's ignoring the complex realities of the British social as well as economic and political situation. I realize I'm kind of a voice crying in the wilderness, but I'm used to that.
Right. Well, I guess part of what probably makes it easy to fall into that. It's kind of the same thing as when you look at a list of the photos or portraits of all of the vice presidents, and then finally we have Kamala Harris. And in the same sort of way, you can look at portraits of all of the prime ministers of Great Britain, and we've never seen anybody who looks like Rishi Sunak. So,
thank you, NPR. Thank you, NPR. Yeah, let me remind you, we've also had an African American president.
Right. No. It's
yeah.
True. Yeah. No, it's true.
Glad to be helpful.
No, I can. I'm just saying, I can understand why there's sometimes the gravitation to that, but I am not disputing your point that there are much more important things to talk about in terms of Mr. Sunak and his significance in this moment. So,
to restate your media point, if you just look at the surface, if you just look at superficialities and what you are used to, it's very easy to translate that to a very different environment.
Right.
Thank you for that dramatic illustration of what I've been talking about.
Let's move on. Let's move on to President Harry S. Truman. And you mentioned in a recent column that he was accorded an honor that, in your estimation, is long overdue, and I think you said also highly appropriate, a statue of President Truman. Is now standing in the U.S. Capitol. This
yes.
happened just this fall. And you tend to talk much more often about President Eisenhower than President Truman. So it was really interesting to read this column in which you really outlined some of the things that made Truman, of course, such a significant figure. And in particular, at one point in your column, you talked about Truman facing crisis upon crisis, or crisis followed crisis, through the course of his presidency. And he had so much to deal with, and at least in large measure dealt with it honorably. Tell us more about your feelings about President Truman.
Well, personally, we've gone monument happy in Washington. There's a 4-acre extravaganza in an expensive property in Washington, celebrating Dwight Eisenhower. It's monumental and garish. I'm sure Ike would have hated it. I certainly do. Frank Gehry, the architect of the stars, Hollywood egomaniacs, corporate egomaniacs, and other rich people regularly hire him. I'm sure he's very talented to design mansions, to design, I'm sure, burial places, but lots of things in the living world. Things that are very, very large, kind of Roman in nature, to the sign of a very, very rich country at one level. We have World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War monuments, which are fine in a way, but the best World War II monument, from my point of view, the most illustrative, is the Iwo Jima Memorial near the Pentagon, which has been there for decades. Harry Truman does not have a memorial. There is a bench honoring him, I believe, across the water from the United Nations in New York. He very, very strongly and immediately embraced and supported the UN, as did President Roosevelt and Mrs. Roosevelt in particular, and others. But it was a very controversial entity in this country until fairly recent decades. He devoted tremendous time and energy to them, along with General Marshall and Dean Acheson and George Kennan and others, as I mentioned. The men and women who led our government during that challenging time at the end and after the war had to confront the Berlin blockade. They had to confront the emergence of the Cold War, shattering hopes of almost all Americans during the war, and a kind of unrealism about a great post-war environment working with the Soviets. He was confronted with the Korean War. Under our Constitution, the conventional approach is to declare war, which we have not done since Pearl Harbor, actually in 1941. But the precedent of giving the UN authority started in late June 1950 when North Korea invaded South Korea. President Truman carefully consulted with the leaders of Congress, but he felt the United Nations was sufficiently established as an international legal body that we should support them, as we did decisively, making a decisive difference in the Korean War. That was the right thing to do, the NATO alliance, supporting not only the Marshall Plan, but the European Union. Mm-hmm. And it was one crisis, one conflict after another, when he took office. And there were similar challenges in the domestic field as well. At the unveiling of the statue in the rotunda, Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, a Republican, Truman, of course, was a Democrat, commented insightfully that no president in such a short period of time made more consequential decisions. The most consequential, just a couple of months after he took office, was the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and then a second time on Nagasaki, leading to the unconditional surrender of Japan. He had no choice, actually. If he hadn't decided to use it, he would have been impeached. But that's not why he decided to use it. He decided to use it because it was essential to ending the war. There are increasing numbers of people, especially academics, who question and debate that decision starting in the 1960s. I've been very attentive to that, and I think it's very healthy for us to do so with such a horrible decision. It was the right decision. Whether you agree with that or not, that was everyone would agree that that was a terrible thing to have to decide, but he did it. Just a phenomenally strong person, as well as a good executive.
You also,
but there's been no monument to him till lately. We're monument happy, but Harry Truman was such a plain-spoken, such an unpretentious man, that he doesn't strike people as monumental. So glad we're talking about Truman.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned in your column is that he was chosen to be FDR's vice president that fourth time that he ran, not kind of haphazardly or
no.
as an afterthought. I mean,
no.
It was very much with people very much mindful of the fact that FDR was a sick man. Probably most people didn't even realize how sick. But, there was every possibility that Roosevelt was not going to live through his fourth term and that whoever was vice president was going to become president. And so you characterized the choice of Truman as a very deliberate one, made with the understanding that he very well could become president. I mean, not that it wasn't still a shocking surprise because it happened so soon after the election, but nevertheless, he was carefully chosen at a particularly difficult moment in our country's history.
Yeah, before the 1960s. Since then, primaries, of course, are dominant in choosing our presidential nominees in both parties. But before then, political bosses, Republican as well as Democrats, big cities dominated in the Democratic Party, starting with the New Deal. But before that, large cities had both Democratic and Republican machines, and small towns and rural areas had political organizations and politicians and political bosses, negative connotations to us. But I believe they did a lot of good. Now, I managed to antagonize some academics, including a good friend of mine recently, by emphasizing that. We got some very bad, terrible presidents and at least one really terrible one as a result of that, but we haven't had such great, we haven't had consistently wonderful leaders since. They were pragmatic. They were effective. They didn't have the ideological baggage and righteousness that tends to characterize influential leaders in both parties today. I really enjoy talking about this because it's such an important topic, and so many academics especially think I'm wrong. Roosevelt was dying. The leaders in Congress especially consulted carefully. It was obvious that the president, increasingly it looked like he would not make it through the war, or through his fourth term. Henry Wallace, an agrarian populist, a professor, someone from radical farm populism in this country, and also very much an academic, was picked by Roosevelt for pragmatic political reasons when the Soviet Union was our vital ally and friend. at least soon after the 1940 election, when Hitler invaded in 41. The Wallace psychology was very sympathetic to communism, utopianism. He was in direct contact with Moscow. And pragmatic, tough, hard-nosed politicians who were essentially, in terms of policy, honest, and were committed to the future of our country during the war, had the good common sense to see that communism is a menace to this country, whatever the importance of the wartime alliance, and being so friendly with Moscow is a terrible weakness looking to the future. So they picked Harry Truman, who was fiercely anti-communist, personally very honest, and was respected in the Senate because he worked phenomenal hours. He drove his old, I think, Plymouth coupe around the at least the eastern part of the country, often on his own, to interview face-to-face defense contractors and visit shop floors and personally go through corporate records and interview like a detective.
Hmm.
It took phenomenal energy. He did at least part of this on his own dime.
Hmm.
He was so active in this area that it went beyond what congressional expenses would pay. It was just remarkable heroism, despite the total nature of our mobilization and the fact that the war was not controversial, the good war, black market corruption, crooked businessmen, and women were as prominent and important even in that war as they are any time.
Hmm.
And he did tremendous service to the country in keeping corruption down during that war. It was tremendous heroism, and the other senators, whether they were in the Republican Party or the Democrat, really respected him.
Hmm.
He was also not particularly polished. He was very blunt, often profane in public, and therefore did not fit the polished image that Americans would really like as a president.
Hmm.
He was a combat hero from World War I. He was an artillery battery commander and more than once disobeyed orders and came close to being court-martialed because he went contrary to directions from the rear echelon bureaucrats. Problem in the Army in any war, I can assure you.
Mm-hmm.
And he was never court-martialed because he always made the right decisions. What he did saved American and British and French infantry and helped prevail against the Germans. Phenomenal man, just truly phenomenal. Very faithful husband and father. He wrote Bess just about every day. She did not like Washington. She didn't want to live there. His mother-in-law lived with them for years. Economically, it was difficult times for these people in the 30s. And for them, even in the 20s, in the White House, when Bess was in residence, his mother-in-law was usually there, too. She did not care for Truman. She never thought he was good enough for Bess. In the White House, when he was president, he was still not good enough for Bess. It was not the best family relationship. Harry was a loyal husband. Not every man in Washington or outside of Washington was. He wrote Bess every day. It was just a remarkable human being, and that prevailed.
Hmm.
We see the real Harry Truman today.
And now a statue of him stands
yeah.
in the U.S. Capitol, and it is a fitting honor indeed. We're talking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear, and we need to turn our attention to 60 years ago this week when the world was engulfed in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one of the things you say in your really interesting column about this is that that there were lessons that remain 60 years later from the Cuban Missile Crisis that are of fundamental importance. And one of the things that you take the time to do is to characterize the kind of leadership that JFK demonstrated during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which you call at one point calm, open-minded engagement. That's an interesting turn of phrase.
Yeah, I think the more we learn about he was much applauded at the time for handling things so smoothly and successfully, despite the chaos around him. He was extremely insightful about the nature of our military and the true risks that we were running. He stood virtually alone at the beginning. On October 14th, 1962, a high-flying, state-of-the-art, beyond state-of-the-art, U-2 aircraft took photographs in Cuba that revealed, once they were developed about a day later, this was not instant digital pictures, as you know. It was celluloid film that had to be developed chemically, even at the top echelons of the spy establishment. And they revealed evidence that clearly indicated that long-range Soviet missiles were being put in place. The missiles were not there on their launchers, thank God. But the Russians had assured Kennedy to his face, Foreign Minister Gromyko, and had constantly assured U.S. officials we'll never put long-range missiles in Cuba, despite our military buildup in other areas. Kennedy assembled an informal group of advisors, not his cabinet. The military actually was not that much directly involved, but he did meet with the chiefs and his good friend and military ally Maxwell Taylor, who by then was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, did participate in these informal meetings that Kennedy put together, many trusted. Everybody was in favor of attacking Cuba. The Joint Chiefs uniformly, especially Curtis LeMay, the Uber Hawk, the ultimate warrior sort of, man crucial to winning World War II, the Air Force Chief of Staff, was very emphatic. He had great contempt for Kennedy and his annoying brother Robert, who was the Attorney General of the United States. The chiefs privately were scathing. They were talking about treason. In terms of respectful face-to-face meetings with the president, LeMay especially said, we've got to attack, we've got to bomb, we've got to have a conventional invasion. The Soviets already had short-range nuclear weapons in what the incorrectly termed tactical nuclear weapons on the island, and Khrushchev, a very erratic and unstable man, essentially very different from Soviet leaders before and after him, he had privately given the senior Soviet commander on Cuba verbal authority, which was formalized in writing but never formally confirmed by the Soviet military command. But he told him, if the Americans invade, use these tactical nuclear weapons. There's also the atomic torpedo, which both countries had explored, a torpedo that would detonate, could be launched and detonate a nuclear explosion. The drawback was it would almost certainly vaporize the launching submarine, so the Americans, we didn't dig it the way the Russians did, for whom war was total, total annihilation, us or them, especially dating from World War II. So they did have atomic submarines. American ships were very aggressive, indefensibly so. Young hotshot pilots, when these submarines surfaced, they would shoot tracer bullets on all around them, drop depth charges that were generally non-lethal, but the Russians didn't know that. One of these Soviet submarines, the B-59, surfaced because of this non-stop harassment. Also, they were literally out of air. They had to surface. And Savitsky believed that war had already started, the submarine commander. And he opened the torpedo tubes. The Cory was one of four U.S. destroyers right nearby. And he aimed it at the Cory, point-blank range. At that point, Vasily Arkhipov, who was not identified and recognized until the turn of the century about, he physically intervened. He and the commander were of equal rank. Arkhipov was the flotilla staff officer. He had staff responsibilities, but he was not in direct command. He didn't physically attack, but he physically implored, as well as argued with Savitsky, that we can't do this. We've got to know more. The commander of the Cory saw that something was going on and told his signal man to signal to the by light flashes and Morse code, we apologize for our American pilots. They should not be doing this. This is not what our president wants. And Arkhipov managed to see that while everything else was going on and pointed it out to Savitsky, who calmed down and closed the torpedo doors. Mm. And the commander of the Corps told his signal man, keep in touch with him. We want to keep that Russian bastard happy. Mm. So it was that close. Kennedy, quite rightly, was particularly worried about the submarine dimension in this crisis, much closer than people realized at the time.
Wow.
So I appreciate the chance to describe this, because we tend to forget the missile crisis today.
Right. And so not only should we be, in a sense, applauding President Kennedy, but also Mr. Arkhipov. I mean,
yeah.
The role that he played, I mean, that without his intervention, who knows what might have unfolded in that highly charged moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing you write about in your column in terms of is that there were actually positive consequences to the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, including some of the lessons that we learned, and then something as basic as the hotline between the United States and the then Soviet Union, that hotline was created, if I understand you correctly, in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis. What would be some of the other, in a sense, positive consequences or valuable lessons learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis, in your estimation?
We had nuclear testing going on in the atmosphere, something that was highly controversial in the U.S., but we were doing it. Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic nominee in 1956, Richard Nixon, the vice president, denounced him for being pro-communist and appeaser because he argued that it was insane to be testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. Kennedy, to his great credit, proposed a treaty to end testing in the atmosphere, and thanks to the momentum of the missile crisis, he was able to actually get that through, something like 85-15 in the Senate, overwhelmingly supported. Republican Everett Dirksen was a key sponsor of the legislation. It ended nuclear testing in the atmosphere. And I believe had Kennedy and Khrushchev survived, Kennedy was tragically assassinated in November of 63, and Khrushchev was removed the following year, there would have been more progress toward arms control. We also have never since, there was a very serious confrontation during the Arab-Israeli War of 73, which was nuclear, which Nixon handled and Kissinger handled quite privately. The dynamics were different, but the danger was very similar. Abel Archer in 1983, the Soviets misperceived NATO exercises and President Reagan's belligerent rhetoric as indicating we were planning a first strike, and they went on full alert and came close to launching. But neither one actually was anything like the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the later crises worked out because of the horrible, truly frightening memory of the missile crisis. Hmm.
You also write in your column about among the lessons learned is the importance of what you call disciplined, open-minded intelligence work. And I think that's a really interesting way to put it, because we don't always think about disciplined and open-mindedness in the same breath. But you put that in the same phrase, the importance of disciplined, open-minded intelligence work. What are you getting at there when you are talking about that kind of intelligence?
Not being deceived by your assumptions, whether we realize it or not. We all have assumptions about the world that guide our perceptions as well as our decision-making. And Kennedy's curiosity, he really was a voracious reader, despite he may not have stuck with the particular book till the end, but he was constantly thinking. John Kenneth Galbraith was close to both Stevenson and Kennedy and was ambassador to India thanks to JFK. I used to tell our staff at the Chicago Council he was a great speaker to come and visit. He was very good at public education. He was a best-selling author. A very pompous man, very arrogant. I used to tell our staff he was the poor man's De Gaulle, privately, of course. I think there's a lot that's admirable about him. We used to have private dinners for people related to fundraising, crucial to our success as a small nonprofit with a very large program and growing budget, I like to stress, and a balanced budget. Galbraith was there with some socially prominent, influential corporate types, and he was doing very well. I asked him about Kennedy's and Stevenson's memoirs, his memoirs, which dealt with both very important leaders. And he said, Jack Kennedy was the most curious man. He suddenly became very animated and very personable. Jack Kennedy was the most personable man I've ever been around, and also the most thought-provoking. And he was part of the Harvard faculty. He said, Jack Kennedy always made you think. He was always probing for information, always pressing to know things. And instinctively, the president realized it's clear that if we attack Cuba militarily, could well touch off the Holocaust, like a lot of junior officers and enlisted men in World War II, especially he had an instinctive distrust of military brass, and they didn't care for him. But it turned out he was right. And this independence of mind was extremely important in his case to his tremendous political success and also to handling this particular crisis. He blundered very badly during the Bay of Pigs in 1961, this disastrous invasion of Cuba, for which he bears very direct responsibility, whatever apologists may write. And he did take responsibility for it publicly, but he learned a lot. And as I mentioned in that longer article that I sent to you from the War College Journal,
yes,
he handled the Cuban Missile Crisis completely the reverse of the way he'd badly misstepped at the Bay of Pigs. You know, a man who really was able to change a lot, unlike many men and women, after you reach a certain level.
Right. And the fact that he drew upon his best self and his best instincts at a time of crisis really says something, too, because a lot of times in moments of crisis, we retreat into fear, we retreat into our preconceived assumptions, into habits from the past or whatever it might be, and President Kennedy found a way to be both reflective and bold at a moment of it that was incredibly critical for the survival of the planet.
It's huge literature about President Kennedy and his family, a very substantial in recent years, part of that salacious and tabloid in nature, a lot of it very opinionated one way or the other. Herbert Parmet, P-A-R-M-E-T, from the City University of New York, did a two-volume biography of Kennedy that's little recognized in the public media. One of the best, most insightful, and most balanced biographies that related, in my mind, to our earlier discussion about the way your colleagues address the important transition in Britain. It's very easy to be superficial, but men and women are extremely complicated. And Parmet's biography captures very objectively, sympathetically, but objectively, this very interesting individual. So I commend that, but you're right. The men who confronted each other as well, Savitsky, who did calm down, Arkhipov especially, but also William Morgan, Commander William Morgan, the captain of the Cory, just one hell of a military officer. Boy, we're lucky he was there.
Right. We were fortunate on all kinds of different levels, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah, in the command tower, in the command deck.
Well, on that note of gratitude, I also want to express my gratitude to you for yet another very, very stimulating and interesting hour of conversation. Dr. Art Sear from the faculty of Carthage College, it is always a pleasure to have you a guest on the morning show, and I look forward to your future visits very, very much.
Well, likewise. Thank you. Glad I'm still around.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll be speaking with the author of a very interesting book about the history of the World Series, the book called The Grandest Stage, which examines not only the World Series, its history, but also draws interesting contrasts between it and, for instance, the Super Bowl. The World Series is a very different sort of phenomenon, and especially the way it has played out over the course of well more than a century. And we'll have that conversation for you tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Ahead of us today, mostly sunny skies. We're headed for a high temperature today of 51 degrees, overnight low in the mid in the low 40s, and tomorrow again a high in the low 50s. This is WGTD